Welcome to With All Due Respect by Eternity News, where we discuss the big topics with grace. I'm Megan Powell Dutoit, and with me,
Michael Jensen.
Nice to see you. That was very Michael Jensen. It was a bit sort of Bond-like.
It was a little bit, yes. Jensen, Michael Jensen.
I have questions about how you did that. And that's good because this episode is a Q&Q episode. That is, it has no answers, just more questions.
Not Q&A, in case yes. You didn't get that reference.
We open by discussing whether questions are bad for your faith. We then get personal and vulnerable by talking about the questions of faith we have that remain unresolved for us and why. And we finish with Amarg and Dave on the poetry of a questioning man of faith, Christian Wyman.
For argument's sake, where we take a debate, cut out the party politics and try to talk it out. And this being our Q&Q episode, that's where we're going. We're going to talk about questions. When someone says, I'm questioning my faith, we often leap to the assumption that they are in danger of losing it. Questions are equated with doubt and doubt with loss of faith, especially amongst evangelicals like Megan and myself. This is the case. But are questions something to be afraid of? Can they even be good? Do they need answers? Or can they remain unresolved? What do you think, Megan?
I think we see a lot of questions. You see certainties and truth in the Bible, but you also see a lot of questioning. And that seems to be okay. I mean, the whole thing with the book of Job is that the answers being given by all the friends are the problem.
The answers are the problem.
The answers are the problem. But the questions that Job has, it's not to say that the questions are necessarily right or good, but they're real. They're where he is at. And that's where God meets Job, although not necessarily with all of the answers.
Well, no, I think God asks him a whole bunch of other questions.
So, that's
which
true.
Is interesting. Where were you, Job, when I set the four corners of the earth in place, etc. You know, can you, can you make an ostrich, etc. You know, he asks some pretty good questions, and that's the answer in one sense.
Yeah, the answer is questions from God, and that's really intriguing that God chooses to answer the questions with questions. I mean,
yes.
What is God trying
to say? To be fair, they're rhetorical questions in the sense that they're saying, "I am powerful and compassionate and witty," you might say, even in the creation, you know, that, and in that is the space for your questions. I can cope with your questions, in fact.
Yes, they're rhetorical, but they're not answers.
No, they're certainly, they're very strange answers. That's right. They're responses more than answers, you might say.
And I think you'd have to say that the Psalms are characterized by questions.
What are some questions from the Psalms?
How long?
Yes.
Why?
Why my enemies surrounding me?
Yeah.
You're going to be able to count the number of ribs that I have. Yeah, they're good questions.
I mean, the questions that come from the depth of someone too. They're not, sometimes I think our questions are quite surface, but underneath them are some real soul-bearing questions, and that's what we get in the Psalms.
So what kind of surface questions as opposed to soul-bearing?
So often when we talk about questioning the faith, and I probably would want to rephrase that or reframe that as questioning within the faith, in faith as a part of the faith process or experience. But we tend to sort of think of the apologetics kind of questions, you know, does God exist? But the question that's often really at the center of that is, does God exist for me?
Yeah.
Where has God existed for me?
Yes, I think that is very insightful. I mean, Marilynne Robinson, the great novelist, she writes a novel about a boy who is in like a prodigal son. And I think he thinks, he believes in God, but doesn't know that God is for him. And that's the source of his disbelief, in fact. That's the profound question that the book asks, or one of the many. So Augustine, actually, in his great book, The Confessions, one way of looking at that book is that it is a book of learning to question God well, learning to question well, learning to ask questions in the right way, and to find what we might call the epistemic humility before God. That is to ask questions which don't assume that you are challenging God as God, as an alternative God, but to to understand your own humanness as you ask from the questions you ask?
I mean, I think that understand the humanness is also that if you are real with yourself, if you're real about the human experience, it is one of questions. And so when we're forming people in their faith, if it's a formation which doesn't allow room for questions, we often are setting them up for that experience where asking questions becomes questioning the faith rather than questions within faith, because we haven't formed their faith in a way that properly deals with the human experience, which I don't think is biblical.
Now, well, I would just want to kind of push back the other way a little bit and say I don't want to be against answers. I don't want to be anti-answers. I do want to also say the Christian faith is built on a confession of certain truths that we can question, but that we do affirm and believe that the creeds themselves are the product of questioning, but they don't give us every answer to that. They kind of frame our beliefs, but we do assert things.
And well, there's kind of like large answers, isn't there? But within those answers, there's questions. Do you see what I'm saying?
God is three and God is one.
So
explain that for me. Yeah, that's right.
What does it mean to be saved? Or and that one particular community might give a whole lot of answers that are particular to that faith community, but aren't necessarily the answers that you have to have as a person of faith.
You mean as in adult baptism versus infant baptism, those sorts of differences between different church communities which they affirm? But
or even I think sometimes the questioning that we have becomes around, for instance, how they've said that we have to be as a person of faith. You know, you have to be this type of man, you have to be this type of woman. And it becomes those questions that are really about grappling with who we are in the world. And if we're sold the answers as if faith depends on very particular answers to those, then questions seem like they're acts of faithlessness, but they're not necessarily.
No, not at all. And I think it's very it's a very brittle way to be, in fact. Mm. What I want to say is the confidence I have is that the faith I have is open enough and the God I have is robust enough to cope with my questions, it turns out. And that gives me great confidence and humility at the same time. I guess I want to fight back against the dismissal of Christian doctrine that you hear, that dogma is a wrong, dogma is a bad word with a bad overtone. It refers to being, we hear it and we hear the word dogmatic, but Christianity does teach truth. It's not just an invitation to endless query. It's not that sort of thing. I do think James speaks about this sort of doubt where the questions become the point, where it's sort of just endlessly questioning with no actual sincere attempt to answer the question or to find truth in it.
Well, I think often there's a sort of a truism that go to theological college and you'll lose your faith. I don't know if you've heard that one. But I think what you do when you go to theological college is that, and you need to be formed well before you even get there, is that you learn answers, but you also learn how to look for answers. And you learn sometimes when an answer isn't sufficient. What you learn is a deeper faith or a deeper type of answer in which it's not reliant on your own intelligence or your own ability to sort everything out. So maybe I'm probably saying something slightly similar to you, actually.
Yeah, I want to fight back against the culture which says that doctrine is poisonous and we don't want a doctrinal faith. I think you can't have a non-doctrinal faith. It's a body of teaching. There are things to know, affirm, and believe, but those actually provide, I think, a great context in which to question and a great way to lean in and to grow as a person and as a Christian. And the faithful life is, I think, resisting premature attempts at conclusion for some of those questions.
Or I think part of that too is a commitment to truth is not about then prematurely resolving something. It's in fact because you take truth so importantly that, for instance, when I come to the Bible, and because the Bible for me is the infallible word of God, that therefore I don't want to come to too quick an understanding of something. I want to, and I don't want to too quickly harmonize all the different bits of the Bible. I want to hold them there and try and sincerely and genuinely wrestle with them.
Yes. One of my favorite stories from being a theological college lecturer was a student on mission who was standing before a class and meant to say, Jesus is the answer to all our questions, but by mistake got it round the wrong way and said, Jesus is the question to all our answers. And I think that is actually a better statement, and one that's really stayed with me, because I think that's true in one sense. I encounter Jesus and I find myself questioned again and again. And that is in fact the richness of the and in strange way the security of the Christian faith.
Well, still to come, we are both ministers and academics, two jobs people often expect answers from. So we're going to get intellectually naked and tell each other what we have no answers for, or at least yet. And then we're going to look at the poetry of Christian Wyman and how poetry connects with the questions of faith.
Now, we've been partnering with Anglican Aid for quite a while now, but they've got a really exciting new project. It's a project based in Ethiopia, and we're going to be partnering with them in this project called Heading North over the next season.
I'm really quite excited about this because it's a community-led project. It's holistic. We'll probably have to tell you a lot more as we go in through the season about what they're doing, but I love the fact that it's partnering with the denomination, an evangelical one, on the ground and looking to long-term sustainable development amongst those communities. And that's fantastic. That's exactly how we should be doing it.
Yeah, I really like their emphasis on water, providing water, but also on peace and reconciliation, very violent area they're looking at too. But if you want to support this project, Heading North, make a tangible difference, go to anglicanaid.org.au and look for Heading North.
The secret life of us finding out what makes the other M tick. Well, one of the job's dangers of being clergy is that everyone expects you to have all the answers, at least to matters of faith. Though if you listen to some clergy, for instance, the John Piper series where people ask him questions, sometimes you're expected to have answers to every dilemma. I still remember one time when I was called up and asked about a Bible question and about how to make a roast. Pastoral ministry. This can create a temptation, I think, from clergy to appear omniscient and all-wise. So we thought we would break that apart and talk about our own unresolved questions, whether they're biblical, theological, personal, trivial.
I really like the way you put this because I've often had to remind myself that you need to say I don't know when that's actually true. Mm. But I don't know almost as hard words to say as I love you. You know, they're really difficult, especially when you're on this pedestal where you're supposed to have, and perhaps you have studied a bit further. But sometimes I find actually the study has made me aware of the questions, aware of the alternative answers. And so I want to give confidence to people, but I also want to show that maybe that question has a number of different ways of answering it. And so I suppose I'm going to start here. I'm a committed theistic evolutionist, and I think that is the best reading of all the evidence that we have and the most biblical. But I don't, to reconcile the age of the earth and the presence of death in the world, animal death, and the biblical accounts is really difficult. Now, there are a number of different suggestions of how to do that, but none of them is entirely compelling in and of themselves. And I don't think that means that they're not compatible. It just means that there is not one way of making sense of the two sets of data comfortably.
Yeah, I think that was a similar one that I wouldn't necessarily say I was committed to theistic evolution, but that I'm committed to God created, and I don't think that's necessarily incompatible with whatever the scientific theory currently is. But yes, when you look at evolution, which I don't have a problem with per se, but there's unanswered questions about how that fits in with God's plans for the world, or even how exactly that happened. And as you say, at the centre of that is that nature reddened in tooth and claw.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
Yeah, so I mean, that's, and that kind of aspects of violence are still questions for me, I think, as someone who used to be a vegetarian for 10 years. And certainly meat didn't come into it until after the flood. But I still have questions over war.
That's for humans.
Yes, for humans, yeah. I still have questions over war in that I don't know whether I'm a pacifist and I don't know whether I'm a warmonger. And I'm not quite sure exactly what the Bible says about that.
Well, it says lots of things about that, but that's the point. Yes, and how to kind of then this goes back to the refugee issue a bit too. Is that like how do we receive the Old Testament law in a New Testament way, given that we will be doing that selectively because we're not we're not commanded to. It's good to attend to mildew in your house, but I don't have that as the status of a kind of command from God in the way that they did in Israel, but yet to take care of the widow and orphan.
Yeah, and yet it's still the same God. Yeah, there's still
still the same law.
Yeah. So exactly. You can't just kind of say, oh, well, the Old Testament God who allowed or propagated war is somehow not the God of Christ. I think that's too simple.
Yes, and so then how to do that nuanced move from the Old to the New Testament, mm-hmm. which has been done. Christians have been wrestling with this ever since there were Christians, right? So it's not new. It's just hard to do in a nuanced, subtle way that makes sense to others.
I mean, I think I'd be a conscientious objector, but I'd have to try and explain how conscience works when it's not completely settled.
You're thinking that you will be called up into the army and put in the front line.
Okay, yeah, look, at this point,
if that's the case, we'll be really desperate. No disrespect intended.
Thanks. Well, sometimes there's also particular passages that are really weird. Like, you know, for instance, the Nephilim.
Oh, yeah, the Nephilim.
With the sons of God and the daughters of men. Like, who are they? Like, there's all sorts of different explanations and none of them are particularly satisfying. Yeah. So I've had people ask me about that, you know, every now and then someone comes across that passage who, you know, because it's not one you preach on, right? And they'll go, what does that mean? I'm like going, I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. So I was asked to preach on Balaam's donkey once. That was obviously, I was a guest speaker and obviously the minister of that parish.
Oh, they do. When you're a guest speaker, they go, have this difficult passage. Yeah.
And that was the same church also asked me to speak about the end of the book of Judges, about the cutting up of the concubine.
Oh,
so I've had two of the worst passages ever for that one church. Big shout out to St. Mary's in Windsor in England. But those two passages are very difficult for different reasons, and partly because you've got a talking animal in one, and in the other one you have such a horrendous act of violence, you know, just a horrendous display and sort of unnecessary excess violence. I've always found in the Gospels how Matthew doubles everything. He seems to I like the clean lines of Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sort of minimalism about him. But then in Matthew, you'll find that there are two demoniacs and that then there are people getting out of their graves and walking around after the cross. And I wonder why he needed to put those bits in because I find them harder to explain.
But I find it, for me, that almost makes the Gospels more real in that in reality is messy. So, you know, if they have bits that are hard to explain. If there's things that seem bizarrely doubled up, well, that's kind of life. Like, it's not a neat narrative.
Why did Mark see two?
Well, he was doing a neat narrative. there's difference in how they wanted to tell the story. Yeah, that doesn't worry. It's funny. Some things worry you and some things don't. And there can be quite a personal wrestling, can't there?
Oh, definitely. I think that's true.
And talking about personal, like, I think suffering is one of those things where I have ways of dealing with that as a person of faith that I think are solid, that I think give real hope and comfort to people. But that doesn't mean I think that all my questions are answered about suffering.
No, I've seen a man in my Bible study who's suffering terribly with an illness at the moment. It just seems unnecessary. It doesn't. I mean, all suffering seems unnecessary. But this guy has really been so faithful and so diligent in trying to find God and has changed so much. And I just want him to flourish in it, but yet he's sort of in pain. He's been in pain for 8 months. I just, that seems, un, it just, I wish, that's a question I have. Why not take that away? And I don't know what to say to him. I find it hard to know. I mean, of course, that's good that I don't find answers. I always want to say, I always want to offer medical help, but that's ridiculous.
You should have gone to a different field then.
I've got to remember that the two answers I have are prayer and presence. And actually, they're extraordinarily powerful.
And I think that's one of the things, in fact, that clergy bring, or people who are doing pastoral care bring, is not necessarily neat answers. What you bring, as you say, is that experience of faith yourself, and being able to sit there and let someone borrow your faith for a while, or to be with them and give them that empathy that models Christ with us.
And don't give them Job's comforters neat answers. Theologically correct, but pastorally completely wrong.
And I think that's where wrong. I sit with suffering, that the answer for me is, as you say, it's in Jesus, not because I have neat answers or explanations, but because I know a God who came and suffered for me and with me. That kind of thing, that for me is my model of answer. It's a different type of answer. It's an emotional answer, not a
because I think the thing is,
one.
We don't know lots of stuff about the world anyway.
Yeah.
Like even if you're not a person, and this is really helpful for me, is to realize that, for instance, the question of free will and determination is a question for secular people too, for secular philosophers and scientists. The question of the problem of evil is a problem for a secular philosopher. If you don't believe in God, then you don't believe in evil. I mean, why? You have to kind of account for why we have this visceral reaction to it. So living humanly is to live with questions. It's not just to live in our faith. It's not just Christians that have these questions.
Yeah, and that in some ways, the fact that we are questioning people, like to be human is to question in a world that invites questions but doesn't give you all the answers, is almost like a way into faith.
Oh, I definitely think so. I think that's right. I think we should invite people and invite those questions. I really hate those stories that I hear of someone who was a young person at youth group who was the question asker. You know, the person I heard this from Lee Sales's testimony. Or anti-testimony in her book on doubt. She was in a church and she was an intelligent woman asking a bunch of questions and people just thought she was irritating. And I hear this often, you know, a young person in a youth group is that annoying person, and some youth group leader takes them aside and tells them to shut up. And you think, why did you do that?
I mean, I was actually just suddenly, and sometimes you suddenly get something from God like this, that I was thinking about I've always wrestled with the peace that passeth understanding and what kind of peace is that. And yet I think that's precisely the peace that you get in Christ, is that it is beyond your understanding. It's not that you're given all the explanations. You're not given the understanding necessarily. But yet in faith, there is a peace that you don't understand, and it's that you can hold on to in the moments of questions.
Well, still to come, we mostly try to restrain our joint love of poetry, but sometimes it has to break free. And today's one of those days, and this episode was a perfect opportunity. Keep listening to find out why. Are you looking for love online? Well, we've got the podcast for you. It's called Love Online, and it's by eternitypodcasts.com. And
it'd be less creepy than Michael just saying that.
And what it is actually, it's a discussion by Christians of finding love online. What should Christians be doing in that sort of space? It's a really different way to date. We're too old for that, aren't we, Megan?
We've both been married for a long time, but I'm really intrigued about this because I see some of my friends just trying to navigate this, and it is a very different way to try and find a relationship. And there's potential dangers involved with that, and your faith really should come into it. So it's a really, I think, a really necessary thing to explore, and that's what this podcast is going to be doing.
And the podcast involves people from around the globe because, by the way, dating online is an international thing. I know people who've kind of met people from different countries, and they have to then navigate the old geographically impossible situation, which is perhaps a little less impossible than it used to be. I mean, I've got some
friends. Well, except for COVID.
No, true. Yeah. Well, I've got some good friends who are married, and they met online, and they've been married for 15 years. Won't mention their names, but I think they're a podcast.
Oh, anyway, if you want to hear more from these people who are in the middle of it doing the podcast, then go to eternitypodcasts.com.
Marg and Dave, two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. And this time, actually, not stories, but poems. The poems of Christian Wiman, who's a contemporary American poet, academic, and editor who grew up in the small Texan town of Snyder, and I bet is the only published poet to come from the small Texan town of Snyder.
Can anything good come from Snyder?
far west Texas. He currently teaches literature and religion at Yale University and has won several major awards for his poetry. As a Christian, issues of faith and questions come up within his poetry constantly. And some of his poetry was written as he dealt with a cancer diagnosis, which he's lived with for quite some time now,
and with
his possible potential looming death. So I suggested some poems for Megan to read. And I flicked them all over. And here's one of them, a poem called Every Riven Thing.
God goes, belonging to every riven thing he's made, sing his being simply by being the thing it is. Stone and tree and sky, man who sees and sings and wonders why God goes. Belonging to every riven thing he's made means a storm of peace. Think of the atoms inside the stone. Think of the man who sits alone, trying to will himself into the stillness where God goes belonging. To every riven thing he's made, there is given one shade, shaped exactly to the thing itself. Under the tree, a darker tree. Under the man, the only man to see, God goes belonging to every riven thing. He's made the things that bring him near, made the mind that makes him go, a part of what man knows, apart from what man knows. God goes belonging to every riven thing he's made.
What did you think of Christian Wiman's poetry?
Oh, I feel like you should have introduced me to him sooner. I mean,
I thought you'd like
him. Like, what I really love, and I think he does this particularly well, what I really love about poetry is it's a way of dealing with reality that doesn't have to close everything off, that allows you to speak about not only nuance, but ambiguity and ambivalence and searching and not even quite knowing what you're searching for. All of that messy feelings and experience, internal experience, and it gives you a way to talk about that. I mean, I think that's what happens in the Psalms to some degree, and I think that's what happens in good poetry, and particularly should happen with Christian poetry. And he doesn't really like to call himself that, a Christian poet.
He's definitely a poet who is a Christian.
He really wants to say that. But as a poet myself, what I find with writing it is that ability to speak into a moment rather than to having to sign off and answer things.
Yeah, although at the same time, I'd say he's very aesthetically tight. He's sort of resembles the poetry of George Herbert, I think, so in his own sort of modern way. There's something quite clipped about him. It's beautiful stuff.
Oh, I think poetry can be very crafted. I mean, I craft mine as well. So to say that something's in a moment is not to say that it's not worked at or a piece of art, but it's just communicating in a different way.
Yes, I would say there's an element of praise as well as an element of the recognition of the difficulty and complexity of life. There's an element of praise of the beauty of things too.
And that's part of the complexity, I think. It's an appreciation of beauty that goes beyond cut and dried beauty.
He hones it like a good poet. He hones in on something. He's able to give voice to something that is not yet seen, or something that we've sensed and not yet seen. And I think that's such an unusual perspective in the contemporary world, because people don't come at it with God behind them. The God of the Bible really pouring through them in that way.
So in the poem that he just read out, I think something that really came to me in that was the bit where he says, God gives belonging to every risen thing. He's made the things that bring him near, made the mind that makes him go. So he's talking about what it is to be human and that God has made us the kind of place that we are, who we are. And he says, God is a part of what man knows, apart from what man knows. And it kind of grapples with the knowability and unknowability of God at the same time, which is something that it comes across so well in a poetic form, that we both experience God as present and at the very same moment experience God as absent and unknowable. These two experiences can coexist in the same moment.
It's a deeply true paradox.
Yeah.
That must be, yeah, it must take this form and beautifully does in this particular poem.
What's your favourite poem?
Well, I really like that one, to be honest. Yeah. This is why I put it up there. Although I'm struck by a poem called What Rest in Faith Rested from Grief, talking about his own experiences of grief and suffering.
Mm.
But he talks about his wrestle to pray. I cry out, if you call this vice quiet, I cry this riot of needs and genes, and I feelingly among the bones and nerves of sounds I make my scathing way. Failingly in church or in the parked car before work I try to pray. What might it mean to surrender to the wonder nothing means? Not to end with a little flourish of earth, not to end. That is extraordinary. I just imagine him doing exactly, I've had this wrestle to pray, and I think that picks up that wrestle to pray in a way I could never express.
I mean, there is, that is a constant thing, the constant being with God and yet not finding God there or finding God in an unusual way. And he seems to bring in creation, that finding God oddly within creation in terms of just being in a moment. So, for instance, he from a poem, 2047 Gray Street, he said, but the world is more often refuge than evidence, comfort and covert for the flinching will, rather than the sharp particular instance through which God's being burns into ours. And he's kind of talking about that oddly, when we come into the world, we don't necessarily get all the answers, but we do get an experience of God that gives something else to us.
Yes, yeah, so much better than answers.
Yeah. And it's such a beautiful way of putting it, that the world is more often refuge than evidence, that God sometimes gives us a different type of answer.
Yeah, and again, suffering has a part to play here. So his experience of suffering doesn't turn him off God or kind of make God unreal to him. There's a poem, Lord is Not a Word, which finishes, Lord, suffer me to sing these wounds by which I am made and marred. Savor this creature whose aloneness you ease and are.
Mm.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure whether to be comforted or disturbed right there. But, you know, the Christian faith ought to comfort us and disturb us at the same time. Jesus is the question to all our answers, but yet also the one who comforts us, who are weary and come to him.
I think that's what I found, that constant interplay in his poems between comfort and disturbing. I want to play a clip here where he's talking about what it is to have faithful literature.
A faithful literature may make you less faithful, may destabilize your faith, may make you realize that you are worshiping an idol, or at least bring all that into question. It can amuse you, it can wake you up, it can disturb you, it can ruin your day. It should be an ice axe for the frozen sea within you, of course.
And there's a great quote in that about the ice pick.
Ice axe,
yes.
Smashing a frozen heart.
Yes, it's kind of that the faithful literature is not necessarily easy, but rather it makes you more real, perhaps. It breaks you open. Which can feel both beautiful and difficult at the same time. And that's wonderful, because I think often faithful literature feels sometimes too closed off, and it's not good literature, and it's also not good for your faith.
Well,
it
wouldn't
be
actually faithful. I think that's the point too. It's actually not faith, not good for your faith. It's cheap, it's saccharine, whereas this is much more confrontational. So pick up some Christian Wyman. You can find him on the internet. There's a number of interviews with him and lectures he's done, but also his collection, Hammer is the Prayer, is a great selection of his poetry. And he also wrote an autobiography called My Bright Abyss. Well, Thanks for being part of With All Due Respect, joining us in this questioning episode, the Q&Q episode. We hope to have given you maybe not some answers, but certainly some more questions, some better questions.
In our next episode, we have a guest who asks some very tough questions of evangelicalism in her book, Jesus and John Wayne. I mean, that title just invites questions already. Kristen Cobes-Dumez. So please join us for that one.
See you then.
See you then.
With All Due Respect is hosted by Megan Powell, Detroit, and me, Michael Jensen. It's produced by Mark Hadley. It's edited by Nicholas Van Soest. With All Due Respect is part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Head over to eternitypodcasts.com, where you'll find show notes and other stuff related to our episodes, and click on our Facebook page to join in the debates. With All Due Respect.
The Eternity Podcast Network. eternitypodcasts.com.au